1649 to St. George's Hill. A ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to Diggins, so we come to work the land.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Kannada. This is May 3rd and I'm your host, Kevin Annett. And with me today is my regular co-host, Ryan Gable, and our guest, Laurie O'Rourke, who's calling in from the west coast of Kannada. She's a veteran activist in the campaign to document and expose genocide in Canada. Today on our show, we're going to ask a twofold question. How is it that crimes against humanity in Canada have been exposed against overwhelming odds, and how have these crimes once again been concealed? Now, knowing how this happened and how it goes on still today is an important lesson to anyone actively reclaiming the world and the law from criminal institutions. And that's one of the themes constantly in the show. You can follow our archived shows at www.bbsradio.com/radiofreekannada. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, and also at kannadarepublic.ca. Now, this twofold question, how have the crimes been exposed and how they've been covered up, is a very practical one facing some of our activists and members in London, Ontario this week, because there's a very large movement growing there and in Toronto, which is seeking to enforce the standing arrest warrants against domestic war criminals in Canada, those officials of church and state that have actively concealed the deaths of children at Indian residential schools, and in this case, the Anglican school in Brantford, Ontario, the so-called Mushhole Mohawk School, which was the oldest such institution in Canada. Now, you'll hear more about this campaign in the weeks to come from people on the ground. And today's discussion is designed to help in that campaign by showing some of the history and the practical experiences that we've had up to this point. Someone once said that truth lies in the details and that evil has an address and a face, and that's what's going to guide us in this discussion. Now, our guest today, Laurie O'Rourke, was part of our independent inquiry into the missing children at the Brantford Residential School during 2011 and 12. But Laurie has a much longer history than that. Since 2005, she's worked directly with survivors of the Canadian genocide, helping to produce our award-winning documentary film, Unrepentant, in 2006. And she also helped establish the Friends and Relatives of the Disappeared in Vancouver that same year, a group that brought the kind of public pressure through protests and church occupations that helped force the Canadian government to issue its pseudo-apology in 2008 for their Indian residential school genocide. Laurie and I have many firsthand and really sacred memories of many of the men and women who were involved in bringing out this change, some of whom have passed on. And we're going to discuss that today in coming interviews. This is the first of a whole series of these recollections. But first, let me bring her on and also my co-host, Ryan. Hello to both of you.
Hey.
Hello, Kevin.
It's good to have you back, Ryan. And
I'm glad to be here. Go ahead.
Well, you go ahead. You had the. It's your turn.
I thought it was breaking up there. I was just going to say I'm looking forward to seeing what Laurie has to say today. I think that today should be a very informative show, and in the next weeks to come, getting this information out that a lot of people probably aren't aware of. They might have heard of genocide in Canada, but don't know much about it. And I think we should be able to unveil a lot of that to the listeners today.
Absolutely, and I really want to invite you at any point to jump in with questions or comments of your own. Like I did mention before, we had some interesting impressions from a psychic investigator who accompanied us to the Mushhole. And, when we're talking about possible grave sites and the configuration of these graves and that, I think you might have some input, so feel free. Laurie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Now, if you could give the folks listening in some background about what, you know, your involvement has been. Let's start by talking about the Mohawk School in Brantford. How did you become involved in that whole investigation?
Well, I was with you.
That's true.
So, I don't know what to say. like what happened, what it went down. I mean, it was a big long thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I know that we had had a whole history before that of working in Vancouver, and then I had been invited by some of the Mohawk elders to actually come to Brantford. I know that you were present when we there was a machine. Now, for folks listening in, one of the machines used in searching for subsurface dislocations of soil, which might indicate burial sites, it's called a ground-penetrating radar unit. And there was a fellow, he worked for the local Six Nations Confederacy, which is a government-funded native group in Brantford, and his name was Clint King, and he was actually instructed in how to use this, and I think he instructed you. I remember you were mm-hmm. actually working with him on the grounds.
Yeah, we went over that site behind the school there, and just how to, you know, how to work the machine and how to cover the ground. You've got to keep a careful grid.
Did you have witness testimony of where to use this machine, where to look for the mass grave, or were you just sort of in the area looking, you know, just kind of looking at a generality?
Well, there were places we were told to look for sure because of some of the witnesses, the survivors that were around us and talking to us, right? They remember something, you know, they remember something over here, right? Some story back, and so it's like, okay, well, we best look over here, right? So that kind of thing.
Yeah, there was one fellow, Geronimo Henry, who had been very public talking about having witnessed children being buried. And he kind of, I remember him standing there with us, pointing to the general direction. And now, when you're looking at the residential school off to the right, there's kind of a sloped area. And I remember Geronimo saying that when he was a student there in the 1950s, that built-up sloped area wasn't there at all. And I remember that is one of the areas that you were pushing the GPR machine on,
mm-hmm.
Lori.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Kind of a laborious process.
How far do these graves go back?
Sure, it's very, very tedious because you have to keep it along the ground, and then when you double back, you're just, you know, it has to be exactly along this measurement, right? So that you cover
right.
everything, right?
Right, and it gave a picture. It was really interesting looking at the screen because you could actually see, like under the ground, it was like radar. And Clint was describing, saying, oh, yeah, this looks like there's been an anomaly of soil dislocation in that. I remember right at the end, and we're going to get to what happened, but he did say to us when we were standing there that it definitely looks like a lot of soil had been piled up on this one spot. Do you remember him saying stuff like that and commenting while you were using the machine?
Just when we were all talking together, I mean, he said that they still had to put the data through proper reading and la la la, right? He was just what he was just noticing on the screen, but there would be a lot more to process with the data, right?
Yeah. Ryan, I'm sorry, I think I cut you off. You had a question.
Yes, I think my connection's just a tiny bit delayed, so I apologize for that, but I have kind of a twofold question. The first one is, how far do these graves go back in terms of dating? Do we have a general idea of that? And also, is there a location? I'm sure ITCCS.org might be one of those places on the internet where we can see some photographs of what happened.
Just on that, yeah, there is stuff posted at ITCCS.org on that. There's a whole report that's posted in the masthead about what we uncovered there. Go ahead, Lori.
So,
On what, the ground penetrating radar? No, I just, that was all. I mean, we just did a lot of that, and I did another area out by the orchard.
Yeah, now, and the, could you, do you remember kind of the pace of events? I mean, at first, I don't want to put words in your mouth, let me just let you tell what happened, but we did get some initial support from the band council for what we're doing.
Yeah, we were at a meeting, a band council meeting, and the elders from the what's the center? What was the center called? Was it the Mohawk
the,
Center, right? Was it?
There was two places. We worked out of the Mohawk Community Center, and then there was the Six Nations Confederacy office.
Right. Well, the elders were. I mean, there were lots of them down there to to get support for that, and there was support. And then the very next day, there wasn't.
Yeah. Do you remember people telling you how that happened or any details of that, why they pulled the support?
Well, one of the, I can't remember the names, the council guys got called to Ottawa, and suddenly the whole thing was pulled, and we couldn't use the GPR anymore, and we weren't allowed to see the data that we had covered. And then Clint went on a vacation, and nobody could get a hold of him, and it was like all very sudden, like within a 24-hour period, it seemed. If it maybe 48, I don't remember, but it was pretty quick. It was a pretty
very rapid,
abrupt
yeah.
turnaround.
The guy's name was Bill Montour. He's the chief of the council, the Six Nations Confederacy Council. And in my notes, it said on day six of the dig of the GPR survey. He was called off to Ottawa for a consultation. By day eight, literally 48 hours later, he pulled support. Like you say, we weren't allowed to see Clint or any of the data that we had that had been accumulated by the GPR survey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that, you know, in the course of hanging there with people, you got to know a number of the survivors and that. I mean, what was your impression just coming in, and did it seem genuine? I mean, if you know, the stories you were hearing.
Well, yeah. Genuine, yeah. I mean, people were relating all sorts of stories from the Mushul and whatnot. And
yeah.
They were all very on board with doing a dig. So
yeah, now that's, you know, of course, phase two here after the ground penetrating radar survey was shut down. There was a test dig at two spots actually, west of the school. East of the school in the forest there. And do you remember anything about that? Were you there the day the dig happened?
At the start. Several of the elders were. There was a sacred. They did a prayer and then they started.
And so, in other words, it was the Mohawk elders who actually started digging in the ground.
Yes.
Yep. That's important because, you know, part of the whole misinformation thing that came out later was the government Indians were saying, well, this white man, Kevin Anna, came in with a shovel and just started digging without permission.
Yeah, I actually had somebody on my show when I mentioned your name. That's exactly what they said to me. That's the exact same disinformation story that I heard.
Yeah, and it's, the disinformation is just, I mean, people weren't there, and so, with the difference, just, you know, so ready to believe the worst.
So it
I'm
was,
just curious, these graves that you guys dug up, what was the tract of land? Like, how much space was actually excavated as opposed to how much you just used the ground-penetrating radar? Was it maybe like a football field size, or was it something a lot smaller than that?
Oh, smaller.
You mean the actual dig?
You mean the actual dig?
Yeah, the actual site where you'd, yeah.
Yeah, there were two test digs. The first one that Laurie mentioned was started by Bill Squire and Cheryl Squire, who were two of the elders who had asked me to come. They asked in a letter in March 2011. There were 10 of them. They signed this thing, and they asked me to come in and ITCCS to help find these graves. And Cheryl and Bill turned the soil on this first site in the woods. And I remember there, the only thing we found were bits of old clothing and bits of shoes. You know, it could have been from anyone or anything. It was the second test dig closer to the school that unveiled a number of interesting things. And the two main artifacts we want to mention is a whole bunch of buttons of the same nature. They were wooden and brown and white buttons. They were wooden and they weren't plastic. So in other words, they're like pre-1950s when plastic came in a big way after the war. This would have been before the 1950s. These buttons were made out of bone or shell, it looked like. And wooden as well, and they were all over the place, along with a lot of bone fragments. Now, let me just—I don't want to jump ahead of the story, Laurie. When you were—I can't remember actually how many of these Were you at both of the dig sites?
No, I wasn't at the second one.
Right. You were at the first one where Cheryl and Bill started to dig and
What were your feelings as this was taking place, as you were witnessing the excavation, if you will?
What was the question?
What were your feelings? What did you feel like as you were witnessing this?
Oh, well, it's all very, it's too complicated, really.
Yeah, kind of an emotional barrage, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know.
You
know, it's talk. It's not an abstract thing for either Laurie and I, because we've known people who went through these. We got to know people very well in Vancouver who had actually been tortured and seen these things in residential schools. People like William Coombs and Ricky LaValle and Bingo Dawson. They were our friends, and we knew them. And I don't know if you want to. I know he was talking to you yesterday about that, Laurie.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not having a super articulate day as it is here. I'm just.
That's all right.
Find it difficult, but.
It is. It's a difficult thing. Well, let's talk a little bit just factually. One other thing I wanted to ask you was this whole misinformation thing came down. What was your feeling about, I mean, you said it happened really quickly, when the order came to shut down the GPR survey and then everything else, did it seem to you that this was being orchestrated somehow?
Well, of course, right? I mean, it was shut down, and it was very effective and very quick, obviously it was being orchestrated.
Where did that order come from?
Well, we don't
Bill
know,
Montour,
right?
Well, Bill Montour.
Yeah, I mean, that order.
You see, we were getting information from people in there's different groups in the Mohawk community. First of all, like, white people often don't understand that the Native community is very factionalized. There's traditionalists. There's government-paid people, and in the Mohawk community, there were three different groups. There was the clan mothers. There was the Mohawk warriors. And they were both traditional. And then there was the Six Nations Confederacy, which was the government-funded tribal council, which had been set up by the government in 1924. You weren't allowed to have any other group on the reservation except the government group. So they're all kind of saying that we represent the Mohawk community. And we were getting information from all of these sources, and what I was told was that Bill Montour, who was head of the government tribal council, was called away to Ottawa, the capital of Canada, to have consultations with the government. Literally right after that, the order came down to stop any involvement in this survey. He was doing the politically correct thing in the local media. The Brantford newspaper was interviewing him and saying, well, do you think children are buried there? And he said, yes, we've got to find out what happened to our children. We're 100% behind this inquiry, is what he said. And, you know, 2 days later, he's shutting it down without comment. So clearly it was manipulated by the government.
Yeah, definitely. It seems very suspicious. If you said he goes to Ottawa and then comes back and shuts the thing down after he had pledged full support. Definitely something happened there. Probably some type of fear campaign threats were dished out.
Well, it's interesting, too, because we had another source within the Anglican Church coming to us, a woman called Leona Moses, who was a Mohawk woman, but a staunch Anglican. She had worked for the Anglican Church as a researcher. And she had claimed that she came across these files of documents that she said, quote, could bring down the church. And this is one of the reasons that we've named this Bishop Bob Bennett as complicit in this crime of cover-up, because she told Cheryl Squire and I, when we went to her home in December 2011, Leona said that Bishop Bob Bennett had come to her and admitted that the church knew about children being killed. They had documents about the killings, including of newborn children at the Mush Hole, and they were sitting on those documents, and she was not allowed to talk about it.
Maybe like the experiments that were done on the children?
She didn't say anything about experiments. She said that, I'm just looking at my notes right now, Bishop Howe, who was the predecessor to Bob Bennett, had a breakdown due to alcoholism. He was replaced by the present bishop, Bob Bennett, who's still in, who continued the policy of gagging and covering up. That is, all of the employees and the clergy in the Huron Diocese of the Anglican Church, that's in central Ontario, London, Ontario, all of them were gagged. They were ordered not to talk about anything. He contacted Leona Moses soon after our digs began at the Mushhole in late November 2011, and he asked to meet with her. He asked her to clarify what she had uncovered in the archives. He was especially interested in knowing about clergy personnel files and the records of staff and students at the Mushhole. Now, here's a direct quote. Bob Bennett told me of a meeting held in 2006 at the Five Oaks United Church Retreat Center, at which a member of Parliament, United Church ministers, and, quote, some doctors, described stories of killings at the Mushhole, including the killing of a newborn child there, and at a local Catholic residential school. Bishop Bob Bennett told Leona Moses that his office had knowledge of these crimes, but that he refused to release such documents. Leona Moses then went to Fred Hiltz, who's also named in our indictment, who's the primate or head of the Anglican Church in Canada. She told him of this cover-up, but Hiltz said he had no authority over Bob Bennett, even though he's the guy's immediate superior. So it's this, you know, this usual game of, yeah, we know about these crimes, but we're not letting out the documents, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That just seems to be across the board with any time there's a cover-up in any institution. Let me ask both of you a question, one for you, Kevin, one for Lori. You guys can kind of choose who answers first. Just in your personal opinions, how important is it or was it to do these digs? You know, we have documents. The church basically admits that they know that these killings have happened. In some cases, they've apologized for them. And we have, you know, witness testimony. How important is it to do these digs when we already kind of have an idea of what's there? I mean, is it worth the emotional baggage that comes along with it to uncover what's been uncovered? What do you guys think of that?
I think the emotional, I don't know if people, like the whole thing of Canada is literally built on these graves of children, right? And I think for Canada to actually have to face that, whereas they don't have to, I don't know, somehow it's all taken care of by a TRC in their minds. Like, I don't understand. It's like all these, that would be okay with them if it were their children. I don't understand.
Well, do you remember what you asked that church lady at the Anglican office in Vancouver?
Well, yeah, I mean, I just said that. I mean, would that be enough if it were your own children, right? And
Right.
Well, that's the trouble here is that, you know, Canadians, especially white Canadians, are viewing this, unfortunately, a lot of natives do the same thing, but they view it as an issue, an abstract issue. It doesn't touch on their heart, their life. And we often say that, you know, when we're outside churches and people come and harass us, we say, look, what if your own child disappeared? What would you want? You'd want them brought home for a proper burial. Why are Indians in a separate category? Why doesn't it apply to them? You know, I mean, I don't know why it doesn't take rocket science to figure this stuff out. There's been a crime. Thousands of children are missing. Why not look for them? You know, this was an interesting debate actually started in the Tekawake News, which is the one newspaper in Canada that reported what we're doing, by the way. There was a media blackout on us totally. Until the smears on us began, and then the media covered it a lot. But before that, nobody covered it except this local newspaper in Brantford. And in it, some of the Mohawks said we should leave the children there, and they were referring to the children in the ground. They were all acknowledging the kids are there. They said we should leave them there because it would disturb them. And some of the others, Mohawks, said, look, they were raped and tortured and killed and thrown in the ground. Isn't that disturbance already? They've got to be honored and brought home for a proper burial. And so there's a division in the Mohawk community, just like in the white world, about what to do, right?
I see.
Well, yeah, I mean, do we as human beings honor our dead, right? And, like, to just... Yeah, I mean, I always thought before that people hearing about more people hearing about this would be upset and want to do something. But I'm even wondering at this point if there would still, I don't know.
I feel like a lot of people go into denial, and they, even with evidence in their face, they don't want to believe that it's real. And Kevin, I mean, even with people's own children, I think there's been some cases I've seen where, you know, a child is maybe abused in such a way where the parent literally goes into denial that they don't want to believe that something like that could have happened to their kid, so they'd rather just think that they just ran away or something along those lines.
Oh, of course.
Rather than accept the whole hard truth.
Well, that's classic behavior, enabling behavior. When children are being abused in a family, the parent is the prime enabler, the other parent, and they are telling all the other children, don't believe these lies, your father would never do that. Well, multiply that a million times for a whole nation and a whole culture, and that's what everyone does. You know, we couldn't have done that, and even if we did it, we don't want to know about it. We've moved on. We want to forget. Why rake up the past? It's so hurtful. You're a bad person for doing it. I mean, I get this every day. But what is being forgotten about all this is that this is a crime scene. And it doesn't matter, even if the victims don't want it done. Under the law, it's a crime scene. And for the Anglican Church to sit on documents and bury documents and silence witnesses, which is what they're doing every day, they're perpetrating an obstruction of justice, and they can and should go to jail for it, as anyone should if they were trying to hide a murder weapon. So I don't understand why people think of this.
They've obstructed the law in that case. And, you know, on top of that, Kevin, I think a lot of this, you know, around the world, not just in Canada and the U.S. and Europe, you know, things like this still go on to this day. And by understanding what happened in the past, I think we can have a better understanding of what's happening today and perhaps prevent, as I believe you guys have, prevent some of these rituals taking place and possibly prevent the death of some children in the process of uncovering what happened in the past.
Yeah.
Yep, and the fact that, well, I mean, it's like the past, we sort of think in really linear terms, but it's present with us now because it's repressed, right?
Yeah, very, very true.
And so it drives our...
Go ahead, Laura. No, go ahead, sorry.
Well, it's just how human beings are, right? I mean, stuff that you repress ends up driving how you behave as a human being, right, and how you relate to other people and how, you know, so the whole society is deeply affected by the deceit and we're built on a mass murder of children, and we don't want to face that, but it's like, think of the growth that we, you know, evolution to actually face what we've done and take some responsibility.
Exactly.
You guys, what about Greg Olson, the coroner? Coroner's office in Ontario. What were his comments about these mass graves?
Were you there for that, Laurie, or had you come back by then?
I wasn't there very long, so.
Greg Olson and Chris Nargang, they were two of the professionals we brought in as consultants. Chris Nargang was an archaeologist from Trent University, and Greg Olson is from the Ontario Provincial Coroner's Office, so he has the ability to go out and, in the case of a killing somewhere, he has the right to issue what's called a coroner's warrant, and they can go into any building, take any document, you know, investigate this crime. Greg and Chris sat there. It was in early December 2011. They were in the Mohawk Community Center. We had the bones that we had excavated on the table in front of us. It was about 15 or 20 of these little bones. Greg picked up this one bone, and we posted the picture on the ITCCS.org site. It's been seen around a lot. It's on the websites all over the place. It looks like a little knee socket to me, but I'm untrained, so don't quote me. I did some archaeology in my 20s, but anyway, we handed him this one bone, and he looked at it. I remember he was sitting there for about 20, 25 minutes before he said a word, and he finally said, I'm 95% sure this is human. I've staked my reputation on it, unquote. Now, after Bill Montour... He not only ordered the ending of the GPR, but he started a whole smear campaign in the community against us. After that smear campaign reached out further, I got a phone call. I was asking Greg Olson to state again on videotape what he had said. He told me that he had been ordered by his employer to drop what he was doing with us. He said, I'm not even allowed to work with you guys even in my off hours. And that's the last we ever heard from Greg Olson, the provincial coroner's office. So in other words, the Ontario government ordered him to have nothing to do with his dig anymore.
Wow, that's just incredible.
Oh, and now the PS to this is, after that happened, I contacted a guy called Dr. Don Ortner. He's a senior forensic pathologist, or was before he died, at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington. His specialty was analyzing from bone remains cause of death. So he'd be exactly what we need, because a lot of these kids were deliberately exposed to tuberculosis and died, and that shows up in bone remains. Now, I sent off that bone that Greg Olson had looked at to Don Ortner. I got two emails from him, and I talked to him on the phone once. The first one was, I haven't really looked at the bone. It looks like an animal to me. Second communication, he said, well, I've looked at it longer, and frankly, it could be either. It's too small to tell. I'd have to come and look at more of these. And I said, well, would you do that? And he said, sure, I'd be willing to come up. Now, that was in late January 2012. He died of a heart attack in April. So you can read into that whatever you like. But what I found interesting was, you know, the usual smear at stopkevinanna.com and these other sites that just kind of smear us. About a couple of weeks before Don Ortner died, this woman began, who was always going on about what a horrible man I am, said, and all that stuff he's claiming about Dr. Don Ortner, he's never going to testify about any of the stuff. And then he's dead. Now, you know, I just found that interesting. It's almost as if she knew the guy was going to die because, well, my personal theory is that these are government-funded smear sites. And I think something happened to Don Ortner, but that's just my personal opinion. I don't have any proof about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been getting emails myself since I started working with you, and even really before that, from disinformation campaigns that have got to have some type of financial backing from the government behind them. There's just no, I just don't think that there's a way that people have enough time and enough passion to sit down and try to defame somebody in the ways that they have you and the kind of emails that I get relating to you and the work that I do as well. It's really, I mean, it, I think it shows that there's, it shows that there's so much pushback. The more and more pushback we get, I feel like the closer we get to the truth. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Well, Laurie, you experienced it yourself when we first got together, you know? I mean, people approaching
yeah,
you.
I got approached, and I didn't run away like they were expecting they would, but I guess, oh my, there's a controversy? But it was funny because I was asking questions, and they seemed sort of stymied by me asking questions instead of just going, oh my, I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, what I've always find interesting is that these smear artists also make reference to things that can only have been gleaned off my emails. So, I mean, how do they access my emails if they're not at least being backed by people with a lot of money? But you know, I'm glad you asked that question about the people we did bring in, because this was not a fly-by-night operation. We did consult people in the know. They both Chris Nargang and Greg Olson were convinced. Well, I've got it right here in my notes. They agreed that the small bone was most likely human. They agreed that the dig site should be worked on more and there should be a professional team brought in. They recommended that excavation begin right away. And Greg Olson said he was going to seek a coroner's warrant, which, if obtained, would allow him to inspect any Anglican church record or building and conduct the excavation. So that would have been amazing. That would have been... You know, the whole house would have come down then, and that's why they had to shut it down, because we're getting very close to the bone with this stuff, literally.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Working with the International Criminal Court of Justice, or the ICLCJ, do they have, because of the connection maybe with the United Nations, do they have any jurisdiction to be able to override the authority of the Canadian government? I mean, I think that probably the church still has some type of authority even above that. I mean, the letter that you got from the Attorney General of British Columbia, but I don't know, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that they have any type of power to override that?
Well, that's funny, because when I was getting tossed out of the United Church for doing this kind of work without cause, without any kind of due process, violating my civil rights, we wrote to the Attorney General of British Columbia, and he wrote back saying, we regret that the internal disciplinary processes in a church are outside the jurisdiction of my ministry, which means it's outside the law of the land. So he was saying in writing that churches are a law unto themselves, and they can do whatever they want to their own employees, as happened to me, but any priest or anybody who would speak out. And that's, you know, part of that, the difficulty we're up against. It's not a normal crime scene because the perpetrators are in charge, they're still in power, and they've been destroying the evidence for years. So that's when people say, well, where's the proof? I'd say, well, go ask the church. They're the ones who destroyed it. You know?
Yeah, and you know what makes it very hard for me and other people who have, I guess, followed in your path and tried to work alongside you is before you and I even spoke, I've had my radio show on several networks, and one of the networks I was removed from for refusing to censor my show about the topics that we're discussing. And the head of the network constantly asked me for, we need convictions, we need evidence, we need proof, or you can't talk about this. And when I would show them evidence of certain things, they would basically just ignore it and continue to ask for evidence of what I already provided.
Exactly. They always do that.
Yeah, you've had
doesn't matter what how much evidence you produce, and they just ignore it and pretend like it, you didn't produce any and then ask for more, yeah.
Laurie, sometime on the show, I'd really like you to sing one of your songs because you're an amazing writer and songwriter, and you do sing the closing song, and Unrepentant, just for people to know.
When they
But you did write some good songs about the residential school, and I remember one you wrote about the Nanaimo Indian Hospital, and what was it, just the next month they tore it down after you had sung that publicly up at the...
It was a spoken word thing that... I talked about it in December. Yeah, and they started demolition in January.
No. So, we're going to, just so Doug, who's our faithful technical operator, knows, we're going to forego that halfway music thing. We're just into a really good conversation here, so we'll just go through to the top of the hour, Doug. Thank you. One thing I wanted to mention as well was, in the course of both the survey and the dig at the Mosh Hole, we were approached by a number of local people, both white and native, who were confirming what we were saying. They said that, and here's this is a very important piece of evidence. The woman who is a curator at the museum, you see, the building is still standing, the Mosh Hole. It's a very spooky looking place, and very strange. Awful vibrations off it, actually. But right next door is a thing called the Woodland Cultural Center, and it's like a museum about, you know, traditional Mohawk life and all that. And the woman, Tara Froman, who is the curator, came to me when we were doing the first GPR survey, and she said the following, that in 2008, let me just find my notes here, she said that during the construction of the Woodland Center floor, they had to tear the floor up and put no one in. An employee named Tom Hill found what turned out to be the forearm of an adolescent female. The bone was analyzed by the provincial coroner's office and then locked away by Barb Harris, an employee of the state-funded Six Nations Confederacy, the same group that shut down our dig and survey. A similar incident had occurred during the actual construction of the Woodland Center in the spring of 1982, according to Tara Froman. The construction was stopped because the complete skeleton of a small child was found immediately west of the former Mohawk school. Froman said she was sworn to silence about the discovery, and the remains were taken away by the Ontario Provincial Police into deep storage at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. So this is what we're talking about. At every level, the police and everyone is colluding in covering up this crime, and under the law, concealing a crime is the same as committing it. So anyway, I wanted to get that out because some of the people listening in today are part of this campaign in London to force... these records into the open to, you know, if necessary, seize records, because we have the right to do that as citizens. If there's evidence of crimes that are being committed or might be committed, we have the right to act when the police don't, as long as it's done peacefully and lawfully. So that's important information for folks in London to know.
Yeah, you know what actually kind of makes me a little bit upset is that the other day I was, I've done a couple of radio shows this week, more than I usually do, some special episodes, and just, you know, kind of seeing how information of this sort, what we're talking about, the residential schools and the mass graves and the excavations, people become so, they have this reflex action of just denying it automatically, even if you put evidence in front of their face, whether it's physical or it's you know, implicative, and people are more excited about the royal baby that's born than they do about the abuse of children. And, you know, I just, to me, it's just amazing.
Well, that little baby counts, but the other babies didn't count, I guess, or something.
Yeah, I guess so. And I mean, I say to people here in the United States, you know, how we this country supposedly fought against that tyrannical King George, and then last, you know, a couple of years ago, the other George baby was born, and people are so excited about that. I mean, I don't know what this obsession is with these hierarchies and these royal families. We have really an obsession with pleasing and bowing down to authority. I don't know if that's something that's been conditioned, programmed into us, or that's something that's just a part of human nature, but it's really frustrating.
Yes.
Well, it's kind of like the celebrity culture that everyone's so trained in, and they're just paying attention to what, you know, it's like the, I mean, the media has that story splashed all over the place, right? So that's what people are tuned into, right?
Yeah, and, you know, it's...
Oh, yeah.
Well, also the thing you find, too, is that this desire to just disbelieve what we're talking about is so enormous. You know, it's funny because when you talk to a lot of people about these crimes, they will say, yeah, I think it's probable that it even happened, but what good are you going to do? Look at who you're up against. You're never going to get them to change or admit or anything. Well, I just want to remind people, in the last few years, we've disproven that. We forced a small little group of us in Vancouver and Toronto, forced the government and the churches to do something they didn't want to do, which is to, even though it was stupid and self-serving, this apology at least acknowledged the children had died, although the churches never admitted that. They got the government to do it for them. And the government's apology never talked about missing children. Who was it who got up in Parliament and talked about mass graves? Gilles Duceppe.
Well, they did. Yeah, Gilles Duceppe went on at great length in French about it, and it wasn't really being translated very well. And then the commentary afterwards, like in between speeches, just totally glossed over what he said. And also Jack Layton brought it up, and that part just went unmentioned in the commentary after as well. So it's like, okay, well, they said it, a couple people said it, but then. I remember Harper even said some died. I was totally shocked he'd even mention it mentioned that much. So.
Well, right there, that's a distortion there, because the average death rate was between 40% and 60% for almost half a century. That's not some, that's half. For a long period of time. You know, and so I don't know.
I would like to know, where do these people, these disinformation agents or these people that just have a willingness to disbelieve, where do they go when even the government comes out and says, yes, children died, and all the people that denied it before, do they just disappear? I don't understand these people's mindsets, how they think. They attack you so harshly for so long, and then when it's proven that you're right, not that you need an apology, but nobody ever stands up and says, oh, yeah, you're right, maybe we should do something about this. They just kind of disappear.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, you'd think that when you're vindicated about something, it would be mentioned at some point. But the more we're vindicated, the more people are in denial about it. It's the strangest thing. Like, I've stopped trying to figure it out. But what we do know is that, like, in 2008, I released a list to the media, which, of course, never went anywhere. But on the list, there was a site of 28 possible mass grave sites, mostly in Western Canada, where a lot of the residential schools were. And... I remember when I still did that kind of thing, I called up the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Port Alberni, and I said, well, have you guys investigated the gravesite behind the school there? And he said, what gravesite? And I said, well, a lot of people have been talking about it, including survivors. And he said, oh, well, none of us were there then. He was just denial. And I finally said, look, if there's a grave there and children are possibly buried, don't you have an obligation to investigate? And then he hung up on me.
Right.
This is the police, right?
That's how they do it.
There you go, folks. Canada.
What is it?
Pardon?
Oh, I didn't know what you said. You broke up.
I said, there you go, folks. This is Canada, 2015. I mean, and so, you know, what can you do? Just keep carrying on.
Yeah, and you know, another thing is the fact that we've had kind of a chuckle here about the way in which these situations are handled by government officials. I think it's really important to still be able to somewhat keep our sense of humor about what's happened, and you know, in studying history and understanding what took place with the church and what still goes on today. I think it's very important to keep our sense of humor, you know, in some way, shape, or form, because if we don't, we become dangerously close to what our enemy is, I think.
Well, exactly, and that's why when Laura comes on again next week, I hope you come back, or in the future, we can talk about some of our anecdotes from Vancouver. We had some hilarious moments when we're occupying the church. I remember once we were protesting outside the big Unite Church in downtown Vancouver, St. Andrew's Wesley, and the minister came out. He was this old fart, you know, maybe he was senile, that was his problem, but he came out and said, "Oh, no, there was only one perpetrator." And I said, "What?" He said, "No, there was one perpetrator in United Church residential schools." And I said, "So that one guy caused thousands of children
busy.
To die. How did he do that?"
Yeah, he was a busy guy.
Pardon?
He was a busy guy.
He was a busy guy, that one perpetrator. But we heard that the other day some of our people in London went into the archives there, and the researcher there said exactly the same thing. Oh, there was only one perpetrator at the mush hole in Brantford. His name was Principal Zimmerman. Now, you know, he did these horrible things to these children. And what happened? What was everybody else doing? Twiddling their thumbs? I mean, you know, so the church's strategy is to do that. They hang it on a scapegoat and then hope everybody else gets off, right?
Oh, that's what they do about everything. I mean, that's what's happened recently with Bishop Robert Finn here. I think he was in the state of Kentucky. They tried to hang it on one person. They tried to divert people's attention from the real perpetrators, the people that really commit the crimes, and they try to put it on the people that either didn't report the crimes or didn't have knowledge of it directly up front, and they tried to pin it on them. They just fit them to the media wolves and make it look like, you know, for example, the Vatican has a policy of zero tolerance, and it makes it look like they're upholding that policy.
Oh, my God. Well, how many people have said that? Well, no, they've got a zero tolerance. It's like, what?
Well, policy is one thing, practice is another.
That's right, that's right. You can come up with as many slogans as you possibly can, repeat them as many times as you possibly can to get people to believe them, but policy does not necessarily mean that you've done anything about it. It's just a fancy slogan, a form of propaganda.
Well, also policy, that's not even honest, because the Catholic Church's stated policy, crimen solicitanus, is to conceal child rape and not tell the police. That's in writing.
Absolutely.
Yep. ITCCS.org, folks, read about it. We got about 4 or 5 minutes left. I just want to ask Lori, I mean, you're our guest, if you have anything else you want to offer, and, you know, I'm sure we'll talk again.
Yeah, I'll come on again. I just hope, like, I'm not always super articulate, like, I can't call when that is, so.
Like, don't worry about it.
Some days are better than others.
You know what? It's like, what matters is what people do in practice, and you've been steadfast in this, unlike the vast majority of people. You know, year after year, you stood by me, you stood by the survivors, and I honor you for that, Lori. And I love you for it.
Okay.
So, you know, don't worry about articulateness. What matters is what people do.
Yeah, you don't have to read a script.
But you do have valuable experience in all of this, so I do look forward, you know, to having you on again.
Okay, I'm trying to get more comfortable with it.
Ryan, any comments?
Yeah, thank you, Lori. It was really, really nice talking to you today. I think we had a great conversation on the show, and I'm very excited to do it next week. I think that it's really so important to shed light on these darker areas of human history, society, and culture, because if we don't do that, this stuff continues to happen over and over and over again. And as people people stand back and they just, well, as long as it's not affecting me, as long as it's not affecting my kids, as long as it's not affecting my life. And then what happens when it does affect them directly? There's no one really to protect them because everybody has been hauled off to some type of mental prison, if you will, and nobody's there to protect the people that didn't want to believe it before. At least that's kind of my final thoughts for the show today. But I've enjoyed speaking with you, Lori, and Kevin, as always.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to flag for next week, Ryan, one of the things I've been studying is the configuration of the graves. And we know in the case, for example, of the 10 children who disappeared from that school in British Columbia when Queen Elizabeth took them away, and William Coombs, who had a witness to that, the way that the graves were aligned, and this has definite cultic significance. And from what people have been telling me and what I've been researching, the mush hole was one of the It was like the mothership of the Anglican Church residential schools in Canada. It was the first one. It was an experimental center where they were trying out torture techniques. And I want to get into this in more detail because it's clear proof of intent to not only commit genocide, but they were using trying out techniques of torture and mind control there very early on. And I just want to flag that and hope we can talk about that a little bit more next week.
Yeah, most definitely. That's just an entire another layer to this story.
Now, just in closing, for people listening, we're here every week, Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific. And please follow our work. A lot of what you heard about today you can read in detail at www.itccs.org. We have been able to move mountains, literally, and all of us can. Imagine if there was 10 times the number of people doing what we've done. You know, this whole system could come down, and we need people to go from words to action now. And get educated first, itccs.org, kanatarepublic.ca. We are reclaiming the nation, we're reclaiming the world, and we're all part of it. So thank you, brothers and sisters, for tuning in today. And we're going to close on a song, and we'll be back in a week.